You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Rosalind English. Hello, and a very warm welcome to a special edition of LawPod UK. I'm delighted you're joining us as we celebrate the best moments and voices that have shaped our podcast so far in 2025. Whether you're a seasoned legal listener or a curious newcomer, today's journey through our highlights promises insight, inspiration, and maybe even a few laughs along the way. So, make sure you're sitting comfortably as we weave together some of this year's most vibrant conversations, shining a spotlight on the sharpest minds and the most pressing questions in law in the UK. The subject of the European Convention and the Strasbourg Court is constantly in the news, and the question of whether we should dispense with the European Convention and withdraw from the Council of Europe is now being discussed in high circles. Lord Sumption, in his second appearance on LawPod UK, feels very strongly that we should, citing the recent judgment in which the court decided controversially that Article 8 of the Convention required that states should put in place certain measures to mitigate climate change. "Few decisions," said Jonathan Sumption, "have so openly demonstrated the Strasbourg Court's contempt for democracy, or claimed for its judges a roving brief covering the whole field of national public policy. The court's self-proclaimed living instrument, in which the rights in the convention mean what the judges say them to mean, is not, in his view, consistent with the rule of law."
I find it very difficult to accept that the rule of law is really what is engaged in that kind of exercise. So what you have is the overruling, courted overruling, of a democratic decision by the entire electorate of Switzerland in order to satisfy the demands of the International Panel on Climate Change. Now, whatever else you may say about this, and of course climate change activists are absolutely delighted by it, whatever else you might say about it, it clearly is not consistent with a democracy. And it also raises another more general issue, which is that most people who defend the convention tend to say, well, it's produced some wonderful decisions that we wouldn't otherwise have. It's given us this, that, and the other right. This is actually a little like saying that Mussolini was fine because he made the trains run on time. The fundamental question about the convention is whether this is a sensible and democratic way of deciding what the law should be in a democracy. And it manifestly isn't. It confers what is essentially a legislative power on a body standing outside the constitutional framework of the nations which have ultimate legislative power over their own law. It is therefore, in the most literal sense of the word, a wholly irresponsible body. I don't mean that in the normal colloquial sense. It's irresponsible in the sense that it is not responsible to anyone. Parliament in the UK and equivalent legislators in other countries, Parliament has a revocable mandate to legislate. It's elected and responsible to the electorate. If the electorate doesn't like it or what it's done, it can boot out the MPs of a particular party at the next general election. None of that, of course, applies to the Strasbourg Court. The Strasbourg Court creates law which is incapable of being amended or revoked, short of actually leaving the convention system, or else short of the Strasbourg Court changing its mind, which it very rarely does.
Of course, it wouldn't be LawPod UK without a dash of drama and debate. Any legislative move to extract ourselves from Strasbourg, or indeed to repeal the Human Rights Act, will encounter strong opposition in Parliament, as did the most recent attempt to legalise assisted dying in Kim Ledbetter's bill, which is now before the Lords. I was interested to find out more from one of the many countries that have had assisted dying in their statute books. So psychiatrist Dr. Mona Gupta joined us from Quebec, where she really is at the coalface of the practicalities of Canadian legislation in this field. I also talked to Alex Ruck-Keen, KC, an expert in mental capacity, who's been deeply involved in the passage of our bill through Parliament. The right to liberty in Canadian law is essential to the right to assisted dying, and Alex draws a parallel with the situation in Germany. If the underlying point is about autonomy, it does get remarkably difficult to allow restrictions.
At a case or the court, I always point people to when part of me says, if you want a really honest discussion about all of this, is don't look here, don't look in Canada, look to Germany. Because the Federal Constitutional Court in Germany said a few years ago, the ban on assisted dying in the criminal law in Germany was just flat out unconstitutional because it was an interference with people's autonomy. And they were super clear. They would just say, the second you've got someone who's got, I mean, to apply English language terms, has got capacity, making a free, informed, settled decision, any restriction on their ability to access assistance in dying or assistance to suicide must be wrong.
So the right to assisted dying has autonomy at its core, an argument that is difficult to resist. A more specific type of freedom is one that we explored recently in episode 221, the right to roam on Dartmoor. The right to roam, of course, must of necessity involve the right to wild camp, unless your walk is only a day-long hike. In spring this year, the Supreme Court upheld the legal right to wild camp on Dartmoor, a national park in Devon. Lucy McCann spoke to Dara Coffey of One Crown Office Row. He's a keen hiker. And he reminds us that there is no general right to wild camp on private land, but Dartmoor is a rare and precious exception.
I would be lying if I said I didn't stick on a little bit of Seth Lakeman and whip out the Ordnance Survey map to decide where my next expedition was going to be, having read the decision. But that's perhaps just because I'm a little bit odd that way. But yeah, it was a very narrow point of statutory interpretation. And as you say, ultimately, the Supreme Court did dismiss the appeal. And in the main, they simply agreed with the Court of Appeal saying that, yes, Section 10, subsection 1 is clear and unambiguous, and that it does encompass the right to wild camp. But I suppose why it's important and why it's an interesting case is that while the specific point of statutory interpretation is relatively narrow, the court does set out some useful principles, and it's a useful recapitulation of the applicable principles of statutory interpretation for this case.
The challenge to this special right to wild camping was dismissed, and there is no doubt that Dara, for one, welcomed the Supreme Court's decision as it was widely covered in the press. In January this year, I interviewed Baroness Hale on her long career in the upper echelons of the law, ending with the Supreme Court before she retired in January 2020. I asked her what she was most proud of from the 9 years that she spent at the Law Commission.
I think undoubtedly the greatest achievement of the team, and the team in what was then the Department of Health and Social Security, with which we collaborated, was the Children Act 1989, because this was unusually a piece of legislation which was able to bring together all the law about the care and upbringing of children, both within families and by local authorities, if for some reason they had to intervene either to support or remove the child from the family. It could all be brought together in one place. It meant that all the principles were coherent, well, hopes, and certainly the same. Before that, different courts had had different remedies, different principles, different outcomes, all sorts of different procedures. It was just madness, really. If you went to a magistrate's court, you had one set of things to prove. And if you went to the High Court, you had a different set of things to prove. And the outcomes were different. So it rationalised the whole of that area of the law and has, on the whole, stood the test of time pretty well. I think I can say that.
We don't often get active politicians on LawPod UK, but a perfect opportunity arose to discuss a piece of government legislation when former One Crown Office Row barrister Henry Tufnell, MP, agreed to come on the show. In episode 213, Alistair Henderson asked Henry, now Labour MP for Mid and South Pembrokeshire, some tough questions about the Employment Rights Bill, currently in the House of Lords. Alistair was particularly concerned with Clause 16 of the bill, which is to do with protection from harassment. A little bit of context here is important. The Equality Act 2010 originally contained provisions for making it unlawful for employers to allow third-party harassment. In other words, harassment of their workers not by other employees, but by a third party, such as a client or even a customer. Alistair Henderson explains.
That was removed, and then very recently, just last year, the Worker Protection Act came into force, which added it back in relation to sexual harassment only. So not harassment in terms of other protected characteristics like race or disability or religion or belief, but specifically sexual harassment. So not harassment in relation to sex, but sexual in nature. And that third party harassment provision came back in. But this Employment Rights Bill wants to go further, and it wants to ramp up the duty on employers to take steps against sexual harassment by third parties. It wants to add in Clause 15 the word all to make it that they have to take all reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment against their employees. So it kind of makes it harder. And then also, Clause 16 introduces measures to protect employees from harassment more broadly. So not just sexual harassment. Now, again, Henry, it'd be helpful to get your understanding of what the intention behind this is, because obviously this sounds like a good piece of protection for workers, but a concern's been raised that this could be a bit onerous for employers, particularly, for example, if you run a hospitality venue, you say you run a pub and you've got some clients, some customers who are, you know, saying something a bit risque or a bit offensive in the corner, and one of your employees takes offence at that and feels harassed. Isn't that quite a lot of a burden to put on, say, a pub owner?
Alistair then moves on to the example of an entertainment venue which books a comedian. It's perfectly lawful what the comedian is talking about, but as quite a lot of comedy is, it's maybe a bit offensive to some people.
And you have employees who say, we really hate this, we don't like it, this is an unwanted environment that's been created because this comedian's saying what he or she is saying on the stage. Doesn't that effectively mean that you're putting employers in a tricky position where they're going to be policing the speech, policing the otherwise free expression of comedians or other entertainers? And that's creating a real kind of, it's part of the kind of cancel culture thing that lots of people have been worried about recently.
I mean, it's quite a high bar there, isn't it? The definition of harassment. And I say that just because I do worry sometimes that it's salacious for the media. It goes down this sort of culture war route. And the effect of that is to distract from the intention, which is to try and protect people in their workplace, right? It's not really a freedom of speech issue. And people make it out as such under slightly false premises because there's not really a discussion about, A, how high that threshold is in terms of to meet that harassment definition, but also because it becomes a distraction from the actual intention of the legislation in of itself. And it becomes fire for certain people when it becomes a free speech agenda. I mean, you know, free speech is good. We live in a democracy. I speak to people all the time about, you know, they say, oh, no, I shouldn't say this. No, go on, say it. You need to say stuff. Otherwise, you bottle it up or you don't have a discussion about it and then you can't flesh it out. So I'm not a proponent of clamping down on free speech, but I just don't think that's the issue here. It's just about trying to protect people in their workplace.
So this has the potential of creating a chilling effect on freedom of expression, particularly in the retail hospitality sector. Let's see how this and the other proposals in the bill survive its passage through the House of Lords. In episode 217, I spoke to animal law solicitor E.D. Bowles and academic Dr. Rachel Dunn about the significance of the 2022 Animal Sentience Act. We're meant to be a nation of animal lovers, and that should mean that we have some of the highest standards in the world. But the reality is this legislation means little in practice when it's not enforced and when it's interpreted in a way that's allowing illegal practices, such as nationwide routine pigtail docking and a failure to improve farm animals' environment when they live in cramped industrial units. Both my guests emphasised that although we have protections for animals in the law, these are very hard to enforce because most of the time, commercial interests and general economic interests will outweigh the welfare of animals. So, as E.D. Bowles explains, there's always this fine balancing act within the legal system, which rarely comes out in their favour.
The dominant image that people have of UK farming is a happy image with healthy animals outside. That's just not the reality. The majority of animals are farmed inside. The dominant farming industry that we have in this country is the industrial farming model. And the problem is the image that people have in their mind is so far away from the reality. So actually, even regardless of labelling or food advertising, in many ways, the pictures out there, the storybooks you read as a child, are doing the bidding for the marketers, for the sellers. So we do have a real problem because, again, like coming back to what I said, I do think that people care about animals. And I do think that if people were more aware of the reality, they would make different purchasing decisions. And that fact is very problematic. I mean, it's hard to reconcile that with the consumer protection legislation that exists. You know, if consumer protection legislation is all about protecting consumers with their purchasing decisions, providing, you know, the right information, and we have such a complicated tapestry when it comes to the image of UK farming that it's hard to kind of untangle that, you know, for that kind of consumer protection position. But something needs to be done. And labelling is definitely one of those solutions that could be used to help with that. And kind of going back to what we were saying earlier about enforcement being left to the RSPCA, in many ways, the same thing happens here. Labelling should not be left to private players. It should be standardised. It should be official. And the consumer should know what each label means. You know, more information can only be a good thing. And people deserve to know. People have the right to know. So there are some labelling requirements for fish products and for egg products to label the method of production. And we saw that when egg labelling, method of production labelling was introduced, the sale of free-range eggs went up by 43%. So when consumers are given that information, they tend to make the decisions that kind of align with what they believe. So I think it can only be a good thing, and it's absolutely something that's long overdue.
In episode 214, Trauma Informed Lawyering, co-presenter Emma Louise Fenlon looks into vicarious trauma in the legal profession. On her show was Dr. Anna Colton, a clinical psychologist with years of experience working in particular with barristers and clients with PTSD and complex trauma. Emma asks Anna how common, in fact, this phenomenon is in the legal profession.
In my experience, there is a significant amount of vicarious trauma in the legal profession and at the bar in particular, especially within the fields of family law, human rights law, immigration and criminal law. And before we think about the factors at play, it would be great to take a moment to very briefly outline what happens in the brain when we talk about trauma. So our amygdala, which is a tiny almond-shaped bit in our brain, is the danger center of our brain. All information goes into the amygdala. And in the course of normal events, we go to sleep, the information gets processed, it gets date stamped, time stamped, filed, stored, and a kind of template goes into the filing cabinet. So when something similar happens again, the brain goes, oh, yes, yes, opens that filing cabinet. There's the template. The memories are stored elsewhere. And it feels all reasonably well known and in the run of everyday life. When trauma happens, and that can be anything that's just deeply shocking, that process, that filing, the date stamping, the time stamping, the storage, it doesn't happen. So the information remains in the amygdala, which means that it doesn't get processed and located in the past. So it still feels like it's happening in the present. And that's why when any information comes in that is resonant with whatever the traumatic event was, we feel like it happens to us again. So that is a kind of a whistle-stop, very whistle-stop explanation of what happens in the brain with trauma.
I imagine, though, that it's something that is resonating already with anyone who does any of the areas that you have mentioned. But I would probably also add to that inquest law, mm-hmm. clinical negligence, mm-hmm. personal injury, sexual abuse, mm-hmm. all of those areas of law that covers that sort of traumatic subject matter. But then going back to how you have come across this in the legal profession, can you tell us a little bit about your experience?
Sure. So I've been married to a barrister for, you know, the last 25 years. So I feel pretty familiar with the legal profession. And indeed, you can hear traumatic content or have something traumatic happen to you in any walk of life and actually in any area of the law. But I work a lot with lawyers who hit burnout and have to either come out of work or take a step back for a bit. And almost always there's some trauma in there because it becomes overwhelming. And all of the symptoms that we experience in acute anxiety, stress, and also the flashbacks, the distress, the inability to kind of stop ruminating, have to work through those. So I train sets of chambers. I train clerks in particular and staff to recognize mental health difficulties. And then in my clinic work, I work a lot with trauma and burnout, particularly at the bar, but in the legal profession in general as well. And there are a number of factors that contribute to vicarious trauma. As you've mentioned, all of those areas where the content that lawyers have to be exposed to is distressing, shocking, traumatic in and of itself. And that can be content through disturbing images. It can be through listening to audio. It can literally be through taking witness accounts because our brain will react to the information in a similar way as if it's happening to us. It'll be different, but it'll be similar. And so if we become deeply shocked or a lawyer becomes deeply shocked by what they're seeing or hearing, that you don't have to have it happen to you. That is shocking in itself. And the brain will respond with the trauma response. And then, of course, there's the weight of responsibility that lawyers feel to obtain justice for their clients. And in some situations, obviously, you know, if they don't win or if they don't get the outcome they want, their clients may be at massive disadvantage and at risk of significant and increased trauma, going back to terrible situations from which maybe they'd fled. So the stakes are incredibly high when it comes to the work that people are doing. And each one of these topics could be a discussion in and of itself. So whistling through them a little bit, there are the other factors as well, such as you need to know what you're feeling. Because if you don't know what you're feeling, you feel overtaken by it and overwhelmed by it. You don't understand what's happening to you and you don't have a frame of reference by which to kind of process it and have a conversation and put in support structures. And you then become increasingly overwhelmed. And then the coping strategies that one can use can be unhelpful in and of themselves. So there becomes a vicious cycle really quite quickly, along with the kind of the common belief that I hear all the time in my work, particularly in clinic, but also just when I'm with chambers and lawyers, is I can't be struggling because I've only heard these stories. It hasn't happened to me. This isn't my stuff. I have absolutely no right to feel so distressed. I've not gone through it. And of course, you don't have to go through it. And it's not a competition in pain. You know, this is not what this is about. And I think it's so important that everybody acknowledges when you're exposed to any kind of content like this, you have a right to feel. And indeed, if you didn't feel, there'd be something really wrong because it's natural to feel.
Now, long-term listeners to LawPod UK will remember the first two episodes in the International Women's Day series where Lucy McCann and Kiran Arahesti explored challenges facing women barristers, such as managing parenthood with a full-time career at the bar. In part three of the series on women at the bar, Lucy and Kiran cover imposter syndrome and how that manifests itself in certain individuals. This is a core theme, and Kiran starts by asking barrister Clodagh Bradley how this mindset affects her.
I don't think that being a woman per se impedes your ability to progress your career, but your mindset can do. And I think I'm certainly guilty of certain ways of thinking that are perhaps more common as a woman. So, for example, imposter syndrome is not unique to women, but I think it's probably more common amongst us. And it's something that I've always suffered from the outset at university, thinking I'd got there through some administrative error until I eventually got my degree result and knew that perhaps I had got there on merit. And the same persists at the bar, but I think that that isn't always such a bad trait because it encourages you to always go to, you know, the nth degree to make sure that you're doing the very best for your client. But it can hold you back in terms of career progression if it acts as an impediment to you taking the next step along the career ladder. And there's plenty of research out there to show that women have a tendency not to apply for roles and lessened until they think that they fulfill 100% of the criteria. And there are statistics indicating that if men fulfill the majority of the criteria, that'll do, and they'll take the leap of faith and apply for that role. And there's some merit in that approach. And it may be that your strengths are so significant in the areas that you know you do tick the boxes that one can manage the fact that you haven't yet ticked the boxes in the other areas, but you can do that along the way. And I think that that may be part of the more male mindset typically. So it doesn't mean that there's a difference in ability between the men and the women, but again, it's how they approach the timing of their application.
We also heard similar from Isabel McArdle on this.
One of the most significant problems that women face at the bar is just that on average, girls and women, I think, still tend to undervalue their skills and abilities compared to men. Of course, not all of us and not all the time, but as a general impression, I see women applying for things slightly later, pushing themselves forward for certain lines of work less or later. And to some extent, we just need to try to find that confidence and make ourselves do it, even if we think, oh, it's embarrassing, I don't think I'm good enough. Just have a go anyway. And I think that clerks can play a role, chambers directors can play a role, not just to let us be steering our own ships entirely alone, but to prompt us to think about, well, you know, you're at about the right level now where you could think about, I don't know, an assistant coroner position, or you could think about the Attorney General's A panel. Have you thought about that? Are you thinking about applying for Silk soon? And you know, I think in many chambers that is going on, but perhaps it can go on more. Perhaps we can try to encourage people to think more about where they want to be 5 years' time, 10 years' time earlier. And I think that would be pretty helpful, obviously, to people of all genders, but perhaps particularly to women who, in my experience, are just that little bit more reticent to push themselves forward for the very top positions, prizes, cases, posts, whatever it may be. I think there's good evidence, isn't there, outside the bar, I'm not sure what there is inside the bar, that promotions in employment situations, that women are slower to apply for promotions, less likely to ask for pay rises, etc. And it's not because we aren't good enough, but it's because we don't think we're as good.
Lucy and Karen also explore, through extensive interviewing, why role models are important and how women can strengthen networks to encourage other women at the bar. They conclude in the end that the bar is in fact a fantastic career for women. The skill set that is required is very much the same as the one required of men. But nor should they be complacent about what challenges lie ahead in terms of cultural attitudes towards women and work. Now we come to episode 223, Behind the Scenes at the UK Supreme Court. Each year, a plucky, lucky group of lawyers is appointed to support the justices of the Supreme Court, the highest court of the land. In this episode, Jim Duffy, who was himself a judicial assistant between 2013 and 14, talks to two current judicial assistants about their day-to-day work, including preparing for case hearings and the unique pressures of the role. Monty Finn is judicial assistant to Lord Sales. He's a barrister specialising in public law, commercial law and planning and environmental law. Poppy Mulligan is judicial assistant to the Deputy President of the Supreme Court, Lord Hodge. We start with Poppy describing a typical day in the life of a Supreme Court JA.
I think the first thing to say is that a day in the life of a JA can vary really widely, especially based on the range of tasks that we have to complete, but also to a certain extent based on who your justice is and the kind of work that they like to get their JA involved in. But I think probably a good day in the life can be taken from a day when we have a hearing. So typically we'll spend a day or two reading in the papers, really understanding the submissions, and the morning of a hearing, I will be summoned to Lord Hodge's office and we will have a discussion about what my initial impressions are. And I think that's really interesting because I like to come in not really having a considered view yet, nothing consolidated, but just start with explaining what my initial impression of the merits are, maybe what points I think are slightly weaker, what questions I might have. And once I have given all of my views, Lord Hodge will put me out of my misery and tell me what the right answer is. So he'll give his views afterwards and we get to have a bit of discussion about what his impressions are, what sort of things he'll be looking out for in the hearing. And then we will all go into the hearing. So the JAs are lucky enough to be able to sit and observe the hearings alongside their justices. And so we'll watch the arguments as they unfold. And then at the end of the hearing, usually each day, Lord Hodge will have a separate discussion with me about maybe what we've observed that day, if his view has changed in any way, and especially what he thought of the advocacy, because that's a really interesting point for me. And I like to hear what he thinks about what might have worked, what maybe could have been played differently. And I think that's been really useful for my development moving forward.
And that discussion that you have with him at the end of the day, am I right in saying that that is after his discussion with the other justices where they've all canvassed their views and kind of probed each other's positions?
Yeah. What will happen is a hearing might be over multiple days. So if it was, say, a two-day hearing, we would probably have a discussion at the end of day one and it would just be with me about how his thinking has developed. But then, yes, when the hearing is finished, the justices will all go and have a deliberation. The JAs are not allowed to observe that. That's just for the justices. And so they'll have a discussion and then I will have a conversation with him afterwards where he will update me on his thinking, what the other justices are thinking. And then I can have separate discussions with the other JAs and we can talk about our views. And I'll, of course, give my views to Lord Hodge in the moment as well.
Back when I did the job, Monty, the most senior justices, so I think at the time, Lord Newberger, Lady Hale, Lord Kerr, Lord Manse, they had their own JA, and the more junior, which seems a slightly ridiculous adjective in the circumstances, shared one between two. Am I right in saying that each justice now has his or her own JA?
Yes, that's right. So now every justice has their own JA, so there's 12 of us in total.
And presumably working with the justices themselves is one of the real highlights of the year. What's it been like to work with Lord Sales?
Yeah, it's been a really fantastic experience. Every justice works with their JA slightly differently, reflecting their own personal preferences and also the workload that they have. During the interview, I had expressed an interest in public law. As you mentioned at the beginning, I used to be a civil servant. And then whilst I was studying my law degree, I worked as a researcher for the Campaign for Freedom of Information. So I'm mainly interested in public law.
And just for listeners, Monty, you're being interviewed by Supreme Court justices even at that point, aren't you?
Yeah, so it was Lord Sales and Lady Rose for Poppy and I, together with the head of HR for the court. And in the interview, you were asked to summarise a case and give your views on it. So it was pretty intimidating initially giving your view on a case which, in my case, Lady Rose had given a judgment in, and I don't think that I disagreed with her, fortunately, but I know that some of my colleagues did express a difference of view from either Lord Sales or Lady Rose and was consequently given a pretty big grilling. That's reflected in the other justices. So, for example, Lord Briggs and Lord Richards, they both had practices in equity law and they are put on many of the big equity cases. And as you know, I'm sure when you were J to Lord Hodge and Lord Reed, if there are any cases from Scotland, they tend to be on the panel as well.
I thoroughly recommend this episode. It's very different to the usual output of LawPod UK, and Jim's behind-the-scenes look provides rare insights into the working of the UK Supreme Court, allowing us to live the lives of the judicial assistants vicariously. They are the right-hand man and woman to two of the UK's top judges. What is the role of the Attorney General in times of crisis? The status of international law and institutions is very much in the news, and along with it, the subject of the rule of law. Shadow Attorney General Lord Wolfson of Tredegar joined Marina Wheeler KC of One Crown Office Row to discuss the sharp differences between what he sees is a proper balance between politics and law, and the rule of law as defined by the government's Attorney General Richard Hermer KC.
Essentially, my approach is that the rule of law encompasses the need for independent courts, independent judges, and a system of law which applies to everyone in the state, and importantly, the state itself. So the state and the government is also subject to the rule of law. That is what has been called the thin version of the rule of law. The thicker version of the rule of law is really that promulgated most famously, perhaps, by Lord Bingham in his book, The Rule of Law. And one of the advantages of writing a book called The Rule of Law is that everybody thereafter thinks that whatever that book says must be the rule of law. But Lord Bingham goes further and he says that, for example, human rights are part of the rule of law, and therefore you don't have or can't have a country which can be said to be subject to the rule of law if there's no respect for human rights. He would also include international law in his definition. And that's the thick version. The essential difference between me and others who adopt the thin version of the rule of law and those who promulgate the thick version is not whether we think that human rights are a good thing or whether we think that international law ought to be obeyed. It's whether we regard those as being necessarily part of the rule of law. So it's something of an academic distinction, but it does have political consequences, especially when the current Attorney General, who I'll call Richard because I've known him for 30 years, when Richard says that the government will always abide by the rule of law and adopts the thick version of the rule of law as part of his definition. So at that stage, it moves from being a somewhat academic debate to a distinction with real-world political consequences.
Last but not least, we have Jim Duffy again, looking at the latest developments in the law of surrogacy. He was joined by Claire Chibarovska and Pauline Choi of One Crown Office Row, Brighton. Drawing from their experience as seasoned advocates in the family courts, Claire and Pauline discuss with Jim the latest legal developments in relation to surrogacy. Recently, proposals by the Law Commission in England for significant reform in that area were shelved.
I'm just reading the letter from Baroness Merrin to the Law Commission, and she says, as you will know, the government has several key priorities that wishes to progress, which will put a significant demand on parliamentary time and resources. This means the government is unable to prioritise surrogacy reform and did not intend to put forward these legislative proposals at the current time. However, we will publish a government response as time allows, and we'll look to consider this issue in the future. So it sounds at least like there is scope for it to be picked back up in the fullness of time.
Well, we'll continue to watch a space that has now been watched for some 40 years and see whether these proposals do find their way into law anytime soon. Well, what a year it's been so far for LawPod UK. Heartfelt thanks to all our brilliant guests, listeners, and our great production team behind the scenes. If you've learned, been inspired, or you've even laughed, that's our greatest reward. Here's some more conversations, more insight, and more coming together in the rest of 2025, and of course the years ahead.